Welcome back to the show, everybody.
Hey, everybody, welcome back.
I'm Diana.
And I'm Eli.
Thanks for joining us again.
We're here with part two of Empress Elagabalus' story and her thirsty hunt for Rome's biggest dicks, slaughtering anyone who gets in her way, and also just slaughtering anyone for any reason at all.
Yeah.
That was kind of her thing, her whole MO.
She loved it.
But how are you? What's happened in the last 2 days? Anything good?
I mean, a lot of work.
Right.
Of course. It was cool to have our first two-parter. People
yeah.
seem to be excited for this next part, so that's cool.
I'm very excited.
We went and saw In the Heights.
We did see In the Heights.
We saw In the Heights.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Go see In the Heights. Really one of the top movie musicals.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Very well. I mean, just very creatively filmed and beautiful to watch. So,
if you're asking me, I would say that I can tell that he wrote it before Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Hamilton is a better musical overall. And I mean that in terms of, I think the songs drive the plot a little bit more and the character arcs are a little stronger. Some of the character arcs in The Heights are great, but like we talked about, the main romance kind of lacked a little motivation at first. Like it was mostly conflict.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's still really, really good. I loved it. And the way that it's shot and directed is above and beyond. I just thought it was gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really fun.
For sure. Very cool, creative like scenes. The dance scenes were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Totally. I thought some of the songs were kind of boring. This is a hot take. I'm going to get some musical theater hate. I'm so sorry. I'm not great at liking musicals in the first place, so I have to listen to it again. But some of the songs I was like, I forgot that immediately.
Y'all may find that I have a much stronger musical theater background than Diana does. I grew up with it.
Yeah.
Diana did not.
No.
And that I think that really alters your perspective and what you're willing to appreciate and to tolerate in musical theater.
I mean, there are some I love.
Of
you
course,
know what I mean?
Of course.
I'm definitely like, we watched Into the Woods the other day too.
Yeah.
And that was really fun.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot better than I thought I would.
And I liked that movie better than the play.
Oh, well, there you go.
But,
that's good to know. And then, of course, we're watching Loki.
Loki, God, I can't. We're also big MCU fans here. And. Oh, don't get me started. But you did. So the thing, can I talk about, I tweeted about this. I don't know if anybody saw, but Owen Wilson in Loki is killing it. I mean, it's just above and beyond, I think, what he could have done. I've heard Owen Wilson isn't a big comic books fan, so he was already like a hard get. So I think you can tell that this is a character they brought to him and they said, do you care about this? Like, if we bring you a character that you care about, will you play it? And he said, yes, I'm going to work on this. And he really has put the work in. I think he could have phoned this in. And he's awesome. I mean, in addition to them being really funny together, he's given a real strong performance. I think he's just real showing a lot of range. I think the ways that he is interacting with different characters, like if he's talking to the judge or if he's talking to Loki, there is a subtlety in his performance that's just very different. And I think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I just, that episode, it really stood out for me. And it's just so good. They've all been so good.
I've enjoyed it. Yeah. I'm kind of excited to see it ramp up. Sort of like WandaVision, where you were like, I'm on this ride. I'm ready for this ride, but I'm not like obsessed with it yet. I feel like I need to know a little bit more about what's coming before I'll be like, oh shit, we're about to do this. Like, because I don't feel a lot of anticipation yet, I guess.
I get that.
But it's also been a very busy couple of weeks, so it might just have been subsumed by other shit.
But Falcon and Winter Soldier was like that too. I mean,
yeah,
again,
it took a minute.
These are not your average TV shows. These are 6 to 8 hour movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't mind making you wait a minute to fall in love with it because it builds like a movie does.
They are not beholden to the rules of a traditional hour long TV show in that each episode doesn't need to stand alone. Each episode doesn't need its own whole arc.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree they do, because they're well written too, but they're not really bound by that sort of more traditional format. You know, you could watch just, you know, any old episode of most pre-2004 TV shows. And I think even other shows, even like Mad Men or Lost or something, you could still pop an episode in and be like, I love this one.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no one episode of Falcon Winter Soldier that I'd be like, I'm just going to watch that one. You know, that'll never happen. I think the same is true for Loki. I think these shows are very much, you know, long movies broken into weekly chunks.
Yeah.
But we could spend an hour.
Mm-hmm.
getting started.
Speaking of gender fluid, powerful, godlike figures.
Sure.
We've got the second part of Elagabalus.
Yeah, you know what? We've wasted enough time here, so let's dive right in.
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all, an abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
Previously on Ridiculous Romance.
Listen up, soldiers. It's Julia Mesa, and I'm going to pay you to support Elagabalus.
Oh, you know what, Elagabalus? I'm going to need a minute before I decide whether I support you or not.
A time's up.
Hey, I heard Elagabalus has opened up the baths to the public.
Yeah, but you can't get in without an 8-incher.
Elagabalus, I'm so upset that you murdered my husband to marry me.
Well, joke's on you, because I'm about to divorce you and go back to the Vestal Virgin, because she ain't a virgin no more!
Will Elagabalus ever find true love? Will anything stop her casual cruelty and rampant murder? Will she ever find the biggest dick in Rome? Find out now on Ridiculous Romance.
So Aquilia Severa kind of falls off the historical record at this point. We don't know exactly what happened to her in the end of her life.
Right.
But it's assumed that she was just kind of hanging out in the background during all this upcoming stuff.
Yeah, we just don't know, unfortunately. Mostly because it seems that Elagabalus shifted her focus to a new man. This guy was a slave turned gladiator turned charioteer.
Total hunk.
Hi, Heracles.
Give it up for this glorious gladiator. This beautiful blonde is a humble hunk of Herculean ham. Now, who will win this epic battle? This simple slave or these three starving lions?
Well, I don't know, but I know it's the definition of a fair fight, Stephocles.
Man, like many of our other characters, very little is known about Hierocles, except that he was at some point enslaved as a gladiator, just like our favorite gladiator. Just like our favorite Spaniard, Australian, Roman gladiator with a British accent, Russell Crowe. And just like him, he won his way up, working his way from spear-wielding gladiator to a full-fledged chariot racer.
And here comes Hierocles, from lion bait to chariot racer. This guy has worked his way up from lowly slave to lowly charioteer. And here he comes around the bend. He is turning left. And here comes another left. Things getting exciting in the fourth lap now, as the charioteers are all making a left.
I'm on the edge of my seat, Bobimus.
Me too, Davicus.
Thrilling. The NASCAR of its day. Truly.
People were bored, you know. You had to watch something. Hierocles was initially a student and lover of his trainer Gordius. Cassius Dio writes that after making his way to Rome, one day, this hunky blonde Hierocles fell out of his chariot right in front of the Empress, and his helmet fell off, and she was just stricken with him and rushed him back to the palace. So what? I'm picturing like Brad Pitt, Legend of the Fall, hat with the water on it. She was like, hearts in her eyes. And she said, you coming with me to Rome? Or to the palace.
And they rush back to the palace. And they fall in love. And Elagabalus was obsessed with Hierocles. And Dio writes again about her desire to be caught in the act of adultery and punished for it. I mean, this is coming back up. He writes, for she wished to have the reputation of committing adultery, so that in this respect, too, she might imitate the most lewd women. And she would often allow herself to be caught in the very act, in consequence of which she used to be violently upbraided by her husband and beaten, so that she had black eyes. He says that she loved him more for it, and even tried to make Hierocles the Caesar of Rome, which is outrageous. I mean, she's like, I'm going to take this charioteer from nowhere, and I'm going to marry him, and I'm going to be the empress, and he's going to be Caesar. So people are starting to lose their shit at this girl and the crazy, crazy things
murders,
she's doing.
All the murder's fine.
Yeah.
But don't put a slave in charge of this place. I don't need no working class Caesar.
Yep. She fought with Julia Mesa about it. This kind of started their headbutting. And the military did not like this either. The Praetorian Guard was like the central part of the military that specifically was tasked with guarding the emperor or empress. And you need their support if you're in charge, because like we said, otherwise you might find yourself getting stabbed in the back. So the most important people to keep on your side is the Praetorian Guard. And Julia Mesa is noticing that they do not like this bit with Hierocles. Not at all. But even her love of Hierocles could not withstand.
She's thirsty, okay?
One particular thing that she liked more than anything else.
She is thirsty. She had this standing order, as we talked about earlier, for people to be on the lookout for gentlemen of a certain description. And this guy, Aurelius Zotticus, was chilling in Smyrna, not the one that we know, the ancient Roman one.
Not Smyrna, Georgia, but...
He was an athlete and the son of a cook. And according to Cassius Dio, he had a huge dick. Now just imagine your dick is so big that it's like a part of history now.
Wow. And this is just a standing order across the empire. Everybody knows if you see a big dick... You better get word back to Empress Elagabalus.
And so they did. Her little birds got word back to her.
Mm-hmm.
Before you know it, Zotticus is whisked away to Rome. He arrives in a huge to-do. They bring a massive escort with him. Before he even sees Elagabalus, he's bestowed with a fancy title. He's got garlands. He's escorted into the palace. Elagabalus sees him and sprang up with rhythmic movements. And when Zotticus said, "My lord emperor, hail," as was the standard greeting, Elagabalus, quote, "bent her neck so as to assume a ravishing feminine pose and turned her eyes upon him with a melting gaze and answered without any hesitation, 'Call me not lord, for I am a lady.'" And the two of them retired to the bath. She saw that he lived up to his reputation. She went all googly-eyed.
Oh, wow.
Melted into his chest and ate dinner while resting on his body. Hot.
Yeah. Boy, a good body and somebody who's not going to challenge your authority. That's all she was looking for.
That's all she needed.
Now, Hierocles was a little jealous. They had fallen pretty deeply in love. But it wasn't really just that. He feared that somebody was going to end up dead here. He was like, me, Zotticus, somebody... This isn't going to end well for one of us.
This is a wild card. We need to tamp it down at some point.
But he was coming from a lower class. He had made a lot of friends in the palace, especially the serving staff. So he goes to the cupbearers, and this is all written in Cassius Dio's account. So we can call this history.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to the cupbearers and they say, "Hey, we got to do something about this." And they find a drug that would render Zotticus impotent. And Cassius Dio writes, quote, "And so Zotticus, after a whole night of embarrassment, being unable to secure an erection, was deprived of all the honors that he had received and was driven out of the palace, out of Rome, and later out of the rest of Italy. And this saved his life."
This is another thing where it's like, my erectile dysfunction is also a part of history. But at least it's written down unequivocally that it was not my fault.
Yeah. Right.
This was a drugging.
It works. I swear this has never happened before. Oh, man. What else did Elagabalus get into?
Well, apparently she would also prostitute herself out around the city.
The empress?
Even in the palace, she would go into brothels and kick out the sex workers there and take over herself. She had a special room in the palace where she would, quote, "stand nude at the door of the room as the harlots do, and shaking the curtain which hung from gold rings, while in a soft and melting voice she solicited the passers-by." And of course, the passers-by were all paid by the palace to oblige her and play the part of a willing John, I guess. Honestly, she would be blowing up on OnlyFans.
She would have a hell of an OnlyFans.
She would have a very wild
She would make sure of it.
Oh, yeah.
She'd be like, "Why don't you sign up for my OnlyFans? It's 10 septums a month. And if you don't, I'll cut your head off."
Oh, shit. I guess here's my 10 septums.
All right.
Can I prepay for a year?
Now, honestly, when we get into it, her gender variance and nonconformity seemed to be kind of the least of anyone's problem with her. And that's not to say they were accepting, because they weren't. And she did lose support, especially from the army. after like marrying Hierocles and promoting him to these positions. But they did take issue with that. But they also kind of went along with it for the most part. Everyone was like, whatever, she's in charge. She's the little empress. And, you know, I don't know, she was young. Maybe they thought it was a phase or something. You know how people are that are less accepting. They kind of went along with it. But really, what really turned everyone away from her were her intense religious beliefs and her, like, spoiled and clearly often violent behavior. And that was what really kind of pushed the public away from her, especially. Cassius Dio says that Elagabalus and her mother, Julia Suemius, and her grandmother, Julia Mesa, would get together and hold these, quote, barbaric chants to Elagabal. And here's where it gets a little gross. They would slay boys, and they would close inside this temple a lion, a monkey, and a snake. And then she'd toss severed human genitals inside. So that's pretty intense.
Historia Augusta makes some of these more extreme claims about her. And we kind of mentioned earlier, it's generally agreed on that this is the less reliable text because, again, people were talking shit. But even if these are exaggerated, these stories you're about to hear are exaggerated, they're still pretty bad. She would invite 8 men to dinner. Specifically, they would have some unique qualifying feature, like she would invite 8 bald men or 8 deaf men or 8 one-eyed men or 8 men with gout or something like that. And she would find some way to mock them for that feature.
You're such a loser.
And sometimes she would deliberately invite 8 fat men to dinner and laugh at them for not being able to fit on the one small couch that she had for them to share.
Wow. Sounds like she was a bad host.
Yeah, that's what I would think. I'd be like, bitch, you know you invited 8 of us. 2 couches at least are required for 8 people.
What a dinner party.
Also, what a body shamer. Seriously.
Oh, yeah,
like earlier,
brutal.
A blemish. She got divorced. Now she's like, fat guys can't sit together.
Oh, yeah. She's making fun of people for whatever. I mean, everything and anything was entertainment to her. She was just kind of spoiled rotten in that sense.
As long as it was mean.
Right.
She didn't have a lot of nice entertainment.
Right.
Seems.
She created a challenge where people had to come to the palace and invent a new sauce for food, right? She's like, I'm sick of this. Come up with something else. Give me something good. And the winner, she would offer a very large prize, something really nice, a silk garment, which was rare and a mark of honor at the time. But if the sauce didn't please her, the person who made it would only be allowed to eat that until they came up with something better. It's like the Gordon Ramsay of her day, right?
The Gordius Ramsay's Pluto's Kitchen.
Pluto's Kitchen, yeah. Welcome to Gordius Ramsay's Pluto's Kitchen. Today's contestants are Barkus the Younger and Tiberius Minimus. But it looks like Barkus didn't use enough saffron in his flamingo stew.
What are you?
An idioticus sandwichicus.
And you're ugly.
Damn.
But it's kind of cool. She did come up with a cooking challenge.
Yeah, one of the
we always like that. Just if you're ever looking for anything you have in common with people in history, we love a cooking challenge.
Just slightly abusive. She wanted to know the price of any piece of food that came to the table, but she wanted it exaggerated. Like, she wanted them to say, like, and here's your roast ham. It costs 600 septims. And you know, when it was like 50. She just needed everyone to hear how much money she had and she was spending. Again, she's never not had so much money. One dinner, she had brought in the heads of 600 ostriches. So their brains could be served.
Ugh.
How do you find 600 ostriches? She did this thing where she held a feast that started in one person's house, and then the next course would be in another person's house, and then another person's house, across like the whole length of the city of Rome. It took them all day. They barely finished by the end of the day. Each course, they would take a break in between meals and go like lounge around in the baths and the pools with ladies and all this crazy shit.
She purchased a very famous and beautiful prostitute for 100,000 sesterces and then kept her untouched as though she was a virgin.
That's not bad. That's kind of like, oh, you're a sex worker. Here's all the fucking money you'll make in I don't know how long it takes to make 100,000 sesterces.
Right. She was like, now you just have sex when you want to.
Here's a shit ton of cash, and you know what? Don't worry about sex anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, I guess she wasn't allowed to, even if she wanted to.
Maybe not.
That might be rude.
She said she didn't wish to have sons. Quote, lest one of them should chance to be thrifty. Which is one of those times where I'm like, kind of a boss. That's hilarious. What a great reason.
I don't want a kid who doesn't know how to spend some fucking money.
I need some wild ass motherfucker like me.
She would bring guests in for dinner and then get them drunk. Sure, like you do. Mm-hmm. And then shut them up in a room to fall asleep at night. There's a nice dark room for you to fall asleep in, drunkie. See you in the morning. And then in the middle of the night, she would crack open the door and release lions, leopards, and bears into the room. Now, they were all supposedly tamed, so she was just trying to freak everybody out when they woke up, either in the morning or worse, in the middle of the night, and saw a lion or a bear in there. But it is said that a few may have died during this little prank.
Probably from a damn heart attack.
Yeah. Or a bear.
Or a bear.
I mean, how tame can a...
Who tamed them and how do they know?
Oh, man. Sometimes she would say that guests were parasites. And maybe they were. Maybe it was a bunch of sycophants and she was sick of it. Sick of sycophants. But to punish them, she would tie them to a water wheel. Like, you know, that, you
like
know,
a
water mill.
Yeah,
like a water mill,
kind
of. Yeah.
From water.
She would tie them to this water wheel and plunge them into the water and then bring them back up to the surface again as the wheel rotated. So kind of like basically waterboarding. Early waterboarding, proto waterboarding.
She also invented an early version of the whoopee cushion.
Wow.
It's not really a fart machine like we have, I guess. But guests would sit down on inflated pillows, and then she would have the air let out while they were seated so that suddenly they would slide off their chair and under the table without realizing their cushion. What a prankster.
Kind of hilarious.
Well, if that's what happened to me, I'd be like, thank God. Oh, my God. I got off so easy.
I didn't get the bear in my sleep.
My bald friend was a lot sadder at the end of the dinner than I am.
But then one time she gave an order that, quote, an amount of public grain equal to 1 year's tribute should be given to all the harlots, procurers, and catamites who were within the city walls and promised an equal amount to those without. So that's not bad. I mean, there was a big surplus of grain that had been built up by Severus and Trajan. And she was like, let's give this to some of the sex workers. Again, very pro-sex worker, mm-hmm. Elagabalus, at least in terms of patronizing.
Or being,
yeah. She was all about it.
Right. But she seemed to just really admire sex workers, so she wanted to take care of them.
Yeah.
She, you know, she was thinking about them.
Again, that's good.
Yeah.
And then she'd have bathhouses built. She would bathe in them once and then demolish them, and is said to have done the same with houses and imperial headquarters and summer dwellings.
She was creating a lot of construction jobs.
Yeah, that's not bad.
That's what she was doing. That's what... We should just demolish the White House every 4 years. Well, plenty of work.
Right. But again, as Historia Augusta says, they even say, quote, these and some other things which surpass credence, I believe to have been fabricated by those who wish to vilify Elagabalus in order to curry favor with Alexander. So she was a mixed bag.
Yeah.
That just keeps coming back to that. She does some good things. She does some horrific things.
Who's Alexander?
Alexander? That's a new name.
And a much easier one to say.
Why don't we get back to Alexander after this commercial break? All right, welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, it's a podcast. Go back and listen from the beginning.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
And we're about to learn about Alexander.
So Julia Mesa, our boss. Our boss.
Grandma
bitch.
Boss.
Grandma boss bitch. She was seeing that Elagabalus was becoming unpopular. And like we said, she had already started to fight against some of these things and try to push Elagabalus into a more popular direction, I guess. So Amias was like, fuck all these haters, whatever. I'm standing by Elagabalus no matter what. Mm-hmm. But Mesa's a bit of a longer thinker, I think, and she was seeing nothing but trouble coming ahead. Mm-hmm. The Praetorian Guard was particularly disgusted with Elagabalus, and as we've seen, their support is crucial. Elagabalus had actually threatened Mesa's life when she pushed back against her naming Hierocles the new Caesar, but Julia Mesa cooled her off and stayed alive, obviously.
Right.
And Julia Mesa had another grandson by another daughter, another Julia, named Julia Avita Mamea, and his name was Severus Alexander, and he's about 14. They love a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
They just love to give a 14-year-old
in charge.
It's a nice,
impressionable age.
It's great, great time to manipulate someone.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, he's 4 years younger than Elagabalus, and somehow Julia Maesa convinced Elagabalus to adopt Alexander.
Yeah, basically, Alexander shows up in Rome, and Elagabalus brought him before the Senate. And she has the Julias standing on either side of her, and she declares to the Senate that she, quote, had no need of any other child to keep her house from despondency. She said the god Elagabal had told her to adopt him. So she kind of like made it her decision, you know, like instead of, I wasn't told to do this.
My grandma didn't tell me, God told me.
I think that she herself was kind of like getting a little overwhelmed and might not have minded sort of splitting the rule a little bit.
Well, plus she's in love with Hierocles and she knows they're not going to have children together. So maybe she was like, yeah, okay, I should adopt. I know I need some succession kind of happening. And
yeah.
I don't know if she's fucking the Vestal Virgin still or not, but, you know.
Now, the Senate praised her for this. They were like, yes, yes, no, adopt Alexander. We think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. They are clearly already thinking this is might lead to something better than the situation they're in. And in Castius Dio, Elagabalus said, quote, yes, you love me, and so by Jupiter does the populace and also the legions abroad, but I do not please the Praetorians to whom I keep giving so much. And it's true, she could not keep those Praetorians happy.
I don't know that she was popular amongst the populace.
Well, that's
that might have been a bit of an exaggeration.
You know, I think that she had a different idea of what was going on than anybody else at any given time.
Well, that's an emperor's life right there.
Yeah.
You live in a tunnel for sure.
Yeah.
So everyone's on board. Alexander was appointed as her heir, and he's given the title of Caesar. Together, they were named consul designatus for the following year, 222. And Alexander and Elagabalus got along great for a while. And if she had continued to love Alexander, she may have survived and you would know anything about her. But unfortunately, as we've also seen, she was prone to suspicion. And she learned that men's favor was turning to the young boy, especially the Praetorian Guard. So Elagabalus started scheming, not for nothing.
She's got Julia's, that Julia blood.
She's a Julia in there somewhere.
Yep.
And Dio says that when someone said how fortunate she was to be in consul together with her son, she replied, quote, I shall be more fortunate next year, for then I'm going to be in consul with a real son.
Damn.
Which is like real wishful thinking unless you know somebody's pregnant already.
Right. I know. Like,
I mean, you know it takes almost a year to have one, right?
Well, and then what? You're going to be in consul with a baby? Whatever. At any rate, she was losing all any excitement about Alexander being around. She even went to the Senate and tried to get them to approve stripping Alexander of his shared title. And of course, the Senate was like, no, we're good with this, the way things are.
So she tried to have him assassinated instead.
Yep. It's a classic move.
The first one failed because Alexander was heavily guarded by...
Guess who?
Julia Maesa!
Julia was in the right place at the right time. She made sure of it. The soldiers and the Praetorians guarding Alexander flipped their shit when they stopped the assassination attempt. They knew what was going on. They were so pissed because everybody did like Alexander better, and they demanded Elagabalus come down to the soldiers' camp with Alexander. They were like, get down here. We're going to talk this out. We're going to work it out. And Elagabalus gets there, and she supplicates and just gets down on her knees and begs the soldiers. And they demanded that she give up all of her sex partners, basically. They're like, you've got this lady, you've got that guy, you've got these people over here, those people over there. Give them over. You got to give them up. We're done with this. But for Hierocles, she pleaded and pleaded to allow him to stay with her. It's written in Cassius Dio, she, quote, pointed to her own throat and cried, grant me this one man, whatever you may have been pleased to suspect about him, or else slay me. And they allowed it. They said, okay, all right, fine. Yeah, you and Hierocles, you can go. Leave together. And everything kind of cooled off for a second.
Which I'll just say, that is romantic. She had a bunch of partners they could take.
Yeah.
And the one that she was willing to save was Hierocles.
I think there's a lot of evidence here that they really did have a strong romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The two of them.
Whether it was healthy or not.
Well, I'm not sure
anything
she did was
healthy. That's not for us to say.
Right?
Yeah, true. But I do think there was some real affection.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this cooling period did not last.
Nope.
She could not stand sharing power with Alexander.
Obviously.
And this time, she just started spreading rumors that Alexander was dying, hoping that people would be like, oh, well, he's about to die, so I guess I'll be loyal to you again, yeah, or whatever. But instead, it started a riot, and the Praetorian demanded she come down to the soldiers' camp again, because they're just like, girl, what are you doing? You are such a messy bitch.
Yeah.
But she showed up and saw that Soemius and Julia Mamea, Alexander's mom, were like at each other's throats. They're fighting. They're hyping up the guards. It's looking like a real serious situation.
Mm-hmm.
And she realizes that it's going to be her execution. That's what their plan is.
Yeah. This is a no apologies. This is, we're not talking it out this time. We're done.
Yeah. It does get pretty grim after this. If you're not into graphic violence, you might want to skip ahead for a minute.
Yeah, just like 1 minute.
She fled. She tried to escape by hiding in a chest, but they found her. Soemius, her mother, grabbed and clung to her, and the Praetorians executed both of them. Their heads were cut off, they were stripped naked, and both their bodies were dragged through the city. Soemius's body was cast aside in some unknown place, and Elagabalus's was weighed down and thrown into the Tiber River. She was only 18 years old.
That's dark.
It's so weird how back in the day it was like, not only do I want you dead, but I want to really fuck with your body afterward.
It's
you
so
know?
Twisted. I just
but I guess if you believe
it.
That you enter the afterlife the way you died, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That it's like a way to kind of ruin your afterlife too.
And there's this element of it too about, I don't know, the public reaction to it. I mean, this was... like, okay, she's dead, and that's kind of it. But then you've still got this hyped up mob, so you're giving them more to just like continue to cheer about and get amped about, and not just like this like, oh, she's dead. All right, everybody go home. Like, it turns into this ritual of cruelty and vengeance, kind of letting everybody get it all out. Their systems to some degree, to kind of a put it coldly. Mm. But that's kind of what people wanted. I mean, they didn't want just she's dead. We hated her so much. We want to fuck up her body. Like,
right,
whatever was left, we want to just destroy that reputation and that image. We want this, like, really non-metaphorical destruction of everything she was.
Yeah, and it wasn't just her body, but also everyone she ever cared about and loved. Many of her associates, they were also killed, including poor Hierocles. Her religious edicts were reversed. The stone of Elagabal was sent back to Syria. Women were again barred from the Senate. Although Julia Maesa retained her title. And there was a rarely used practice called damnatio memoriae, which erased a person's history from the public record, and they enacted that right quick.
Yeah, I mean, this was as harsh a punishment as you can give, almost. I mean, they scrubbed her from the record, and this is why we have so little information about her today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cassius Dio was writing books about all kinds of goings-on at the time. He had stories that he transcribed, and there's a couple of other works too, but in terms of official records, totally scrubbed. Take her out. And the same of Soemius. They actually had her declared a public enemy for siding with Elagabalus. Meanwhile, Julia Maesa, she knew what she was doing. She took Alexander's side, and she continued to influence his rule alongside his mother, Julia Mamia. She died sometime in the following like 2 to 5 years, but she was deified, and she appears on some coins, especially from like the Syrian area, where she's riding on the back of a peacock. Again, not too much information about her, but a lot more than the rest of the family. And remember old Camazon? He actually survived this, and he managed to keep his city prefect job, which was pretty crazy. That guy knew how to win.
Yeah. It's the real little finger of this Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Now, Alexander continued to rule until 235, when he and his mother were also assassinated by disgruntled guards. So it's just history just repeating itself over and over again. Again, Roman emperor, hard pass. Not taking that job.
Yeah, these guards stay mad. Like, they're not, they're always mad.
They're going to find a reason to be pissed off.
Well, they have a shit gig, so I guess I would be too.
And this is, what's their recourse? You know, it's not like they can go out and vote every 4 years because they're pissed off.
I know. Voting is really, y'all should really be leaning into this voting thing. There are other ways.
All right, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and finish up the conversation about Elagabalus.
And we're back.
It is stated over and over and over again in the modern research and analysis of Elagabalus that we can't really say that she was someone that would have fit well into the contemporary understanding of gender theory or feminism. She was fully a product of her time, mm-hmm. right? And it's been almost 2,000 years since she was alive, so obviously she herself didn't have the background of modern trans discourse to apply to her identity. But as you heard in the story, she also consistently asked to be referred to as a woman, as a lady, as an empress, as a wife. Her records were purged from official Roman records after her death, like we said. And Anna Burns in Spectrum South writes that, quote, Roman historians had a fundamentally different view of what history is. They viewed history as records of the state, not personal lives, and as propaganda. Right? So in theory, given how documentation would sometimes attack an individual's sexual identity as a means of destroying or harming their character. For example, there were attacks on Julius Caesar claiming that he enjoyed gay sex and that he was a submissive, or they basically called Julius Caesar a bottom in an attempt to disrupt his character, the current age, because ancient Rome was like, especially Western ancient Rome, was hyper-masculine. So we could suggest that Elagabalus' entire gender variance could be fabricated or at least exaggerated by historians from that era. And also makingqueerhistory.com suggests that Roman xenophobia and racism at the time might also have attributed her femininity to Syrian stereotypes. I mean, again, femininity was among the highest insults to these guys because they sucked in many ways. But
it's like a real Facebook group going on here.
Yeah. But they did have this sort of prejudice against Eastern Romans that they were more effeminate and fancy. And this was something that was very negative to them. So this also could have been exaggerated as an attack.
But Anna Burns points out that the three texts that do exist that discuss her, which is Cassius Dio, Historia Augusta, and the Marius Maximus biographies, all of them agree that she preferred to be referred to as a woman. So some of her atrocities may be exaggerated, but what we see from them is that she was very unliked. She was not popular, and her behavior was violent and not just shocking. So we probably have an exaggerated picture of what actually happened.
MakingQueerHistory.com also says, I'm just going to read this quote here. Another thing worth noting is that Elagabalus came into power when she was 14. Part of the reason why people followed her so easily was because of how highly sexualized young boys were in that time and in that culture. And though Elagabalus would later make it clear that she was a woman, society saw her as a young boy and sexualized her as such. Because of this, the amount of agency Elagabalus had when making large decisions is questionable at best. Much of her bad behavior may be better understood when you consider that she was a 14-year-old with the power that most grown adults can't handle.
It's a great point. I mean, again, teenage years, wilding out, living in a palace. Everyone has to do exactly what you say.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'd be chopping off genitals and throwing them to snakes, but but I think, yeah, you would definitely become, well, and who knows what was like normalized for her too in that palace. Like, did she come up with the idea to kill a bunch of people after she came to power? Or did somebody say, this is what you do?
Yeah.
You can't trust them. You can't trust them.
Right.
You have to get them. You have to get them. You know what I mean? You know, I feel like there's got to be somebody in this story and we just don't know who they are. Who kind of was like, yeah, let me encourage this excess to a degree.
Speculation station. Yes. Who was whispering in Elagabalus' ear? Because I got a theory. What if it was Cassius Dio? He was a senator at the time. What if he's like, I'm going to make myself the best story anyone's ever written. Hey, kid, Get over here. I got some ideas for you. Hey, that guy looked at you funny. Don't you think this Bassus guy probably didn't like what you were doing? Don't you think these coins might be the beginnings of a rebellion? Yeah, I know it's just some jewelry the guy made for his girlfriend, but looks like a rebellion to me. I don't know.
I mean, I'm not saying anything. It's just that I heard that they were saying that you did. It's probably nothing. It's probably nothing. Just forget I said anything. Have a great day.
I mean, in all honesty, we do know who was whispering in her ear, and it was Julia Mesa.
Right, right.
Who was, again, pulling all the strings and always managed to come out on top, that Julia Mesa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess she's kind of the little finger.
Yeah, she did accurately. Have the weather vane. She knew which way that wind was blowing at any given time. So there's this frequently quoted article by a guy named John Idale from the Good Men Project, and I wanted to read that now. Almost all the modern discourse quotes this somewhere in their writings. One could perhaps single out as admirable her determination to be as open as possible about her sexuality and about her own perceptions of her gender. But what of her equal determination to enforce her own religion, or her habit of having her critics murdered, or her attempts to dispose of the young Alexander? Personally, I just like knowing that there were people like Elagabalus around. I like stumbling across them in corners of history where they were not expected, regardless of whether or not a case can be made for them having lived inspirational lives. Elagabalus' trajectory as emperor was determined less by her gender and sexuality than by the fact that she was a spoiled teenager who had suddenly found herself to be in possession of absolute power. Like Caligula, Nero, and Commodus, she paid the inevitable price for being no good at a job that she clearly should never have been given. In this respect, at least, there was a certain tragic normality to her reign, and any history that finds a more prominent place for the empress should perhaps also find a place for that fact. I mean, it can't be said any more clearly than that, I think, that it, you know, this was someone who just was in a position that she shouldn't have been in. I mean, from before she was empress, I think. She was already a really powerful teenager with all the money in the world, with, I think, not a lot of perspective on what Rome as a whole was like, because she came from such a wealthy religious place. And I don't know, how much can you expect from someone like that, put in that position of power?
It's very true. You have to keep it in mind. I know it wasn't quite the same, you know, 14 at that time.
Right.
Practically middle age, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what the lifespans were, but
yeah, I mean, they lived into their 60s and 70s. I mean, yeah. You know, but still, you kind of were closer to what we think of as an adult today, younger than we would today. You know, I mean, you were
definitely,
you were working. It was not uncommon, I think, to have younger
marriages.
Arranged. Yeah.
I mean, they were already like, you should be a high priest. They were like, Alexander's 14, time for him to take over.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it just seems like an age that people were kind of cool with. Like 18, you can smoke, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's fine. You know, kind of just a different perspective on that age, I guess, just to say. But still a human being, still likely going through puberty at this time, at these ages, and having growing up rich already, but then being thrust into this incredibly powerful position where she literally could spend money however she wanted, treat people however she wanted. You know, I mean, obviously there's consequences, as we've seen, but they take a while, you know what I mean? And you, if you're established, it becomes very difficult to root you out and build a rebellion around you. Another reason why I'm like, maybe somebody's like talking in her ear, because they're like, if you're really brutal, people won't, you know what I mean? They'll be too afraid to step to you or whatever. And so she's like, yeah, let's go extra hard on all these dudes, you know?
Well,
again, I'm totally speculating there, but.
Well, that's all we're doing now. Going back to the religious element too. Here's someone who basically believed that she was imbued with the power of a god, right? So when I think you've got that kind of foundation of your beliefs, I think maybe that's why so many Roman emperors, you know, took the job and got killed, because they didn't believe that could possibly happen. Even if it happened 100 times before, but not me. Mm. I'm chosen. I'm special.
I'm the main character.
I'm the main character.
Yeah.
And what a character, you know, literally in
charge.
She
really was the main character, though. I mean, not everybody is, but
that's
she
true.
Was.
But man, what does that do for your mindset and, you know, your belief about your consequences. Again, I mean, like you said, they take a while to come around. And why would you think they were ever going to come around?
Right.
You know, if they're not immediate. And she probably didn't grow up with a lot of consequences for many of her actions.
No.
And I mean, grow up. Again, we're talking about until she was 14. I mean, she died at 18. So how much opportunity did she have to grow? You can't separate the fact that she did terrible things and hurt a lot of people, killed a lot of people. But, you know, that's bad. Okay, for us, this is the first time I've ever heard of her.
Same.
And I think this is fucking fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found out about her and learned about her through a lot of, you know, contemporary LGBT blogs, some trans discourse, some just about queerness. And they sort of point to her as a famous trans historical figure. So in my, you know, in our cis-ass education, public school in the suburbs, obviously, she never came up. And again, there's not that much information about there. And there's so many Roman emperors, you know, you can't learn about them all. But I think it's cool that she's there, and I think she's really worth learning about.
Yeah, in fact, from Making Queer History, they say, quote, "Though she was undoubtedly worth remembering, she may also be one of the people in the queer community's history that isn't deserving of any reverence. She was queer, and she was also a very violent and justifiably hated person. But her bad behavior was not because of her queerness. It is far more likely that her age played the biggest part in her terrible decisions." I would also say the money.
Yeah, the money and the heavy
religion.
You
grow up with a lot of money, you get into a lot of money, you have so much to spend that nobody can say nothing to you. I think it makes you make bad decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at that level, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She clearly had a lot going on.
Yeah. Elagabalus, not a hero by any means.
No.
But definitely one of these complicated people of history, totally worth looking at, definitely worth knowing about. People were people all throughout history, and they told jokes, and they pranked, and they acted like dicks, and they looked for dick. And, you know, I mean, that's what's fun to me about looking into history, is finding these characters and these, like, they seem kind of modern in a lot of their sensibilities and what they wanted and stuff like that. And it just reminds you that they were still human, even though their culture is so different and their time period was different and they had different learning and different knowledge than I have.
Yeah.
They were a lot like me. They were a lot like you. You know what I mean? They were just wilding out, bouncing around, reacting to things.
Right. But what a story. I'm really glad to have learned about her, like we've been saying, and we could just keep re-saying it over and over again. But she was cool, she was complicated, and she was horrible all together at once. So, you know, let us know your thoughts, because this is definitely a thought-provoking person. There are so many stories in ancient Rome. I mean, ancient Rome was around for 38 million years. So God, it's so late to get into this, but I do love the sort of time crunch. I think we've talked about it a little bit before about, you know, when things happened in historical eras that were hundreds of years apart, but we condensed them, I think, back in our mind. I mean, I feel like not literally, but there was a part of me that thought, oh, ancient Rome was from, you know, 10,000 BC to 1500 AD, and Julius Caesar was emperor for most of it.
Wow.
That's like, obviously doesn't
was
make
he
any
a
sense.
Vampire?
But you have that sort of condensing of history, I think, that happens in your brain where you think these eras all stacked on top of each other and everybody knew each other, but they didn't. I mean,
I think we have that with ancient history more than modern history.
Yeah.
Because, like, modern history is that meme where it's Barbara Walters, Anne Frank, and Martin Luther King were all born in the same year, but we think of them as, like, totally different eras of time, you know, like 50 years ago, so long ago, but it's like 210 AD.
Uh-huh.
Well, whatever. It's all the same as the cavemen and the dinosaurs or whatever.
Look, reach out. Talk to us. Tell us what you think about the show, about Elagabalus, about other stories you might want us to tell. We want to hear them. I mean, we've got a list that's going to take us well past the new year. But we'd love to hear what you guys think, too, because sometimes we find one that's just like, yes. I mean, I didn't find this story until last week, and we had to jump in with it right away because it's so wild.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, we are romance@iheartmedia.com.
That's right. And you can reach out to us on social medias. We're on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Oh Great, It's Eli.
I'm at Diana Might Boom. And we also have at Ridic Romance on Instagram and Twitter, too. So you can follow that or message us there.
And we can't wait for the next one. We'll see you with the next episode.
So long, friends, it's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.